You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many experts claim the U.S. economy is gradually recovering from the financial meltdown that began in 2007. But Richard Duncan, a former financial specialist for the World Bank and a U.S. economic analyst, warns us that a Great Depression could be fast approaching if we don't take some immediate actions. In his book, The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, he describes how although credit expansion created prosperity in the United States, that growth is not sustainable unless the government's spending priorities change. This book is published by Wiley. I'm very pleased it has brought Richard Duncan to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
So what you live in Asia. How much do you really, how aware are you of what's going on in the United States every day in the United States economy?
Well, I think you can have a pretty good idea of what's going on in the U.S. economy just by looking at the statistics. Of course, I also have access to American television, but I'm not on the ground, so I don't feel the actual what's going on with the people so much.
Well, your subtitle is about the breakdown of the paper money economy. Hasn't the paper money economy served the U.S. well for quite a while now?
It has created enormous economic growth. The problem is now we're teetering on the verge of a new Great Depression because the paper money denominated credit explosion doesn't seem to be able to create any more growth because credit can't expand any further in the private sector.
Are you arguing that we should return to the gold standard?
No, I'm not. I don't think there's any way to go back to the gold standard.
Well, what are other countries doing? Are they suffering from similar kinds of situations that the United States is?
The U.S. economy has driven global economic growth since World War II. So in the U.S., total credit in this country went from $1 trillion in 1964 to $50 trillion in 2007. So from $1 trillion to $50 trillion, a 50-fold increase in 43 years. And that not only drove the U.S. economy, but it drove the global economy.
But you said you're not for returning to the gold standard, and yet all of the problems we're facing today are to some degree as a result for us leaving the gold standard, aren't they?
Yes, I think that's right. If we had remained on the gold standard, then we would have had much slower global economic growth than we have had. But again, we would now be threatened with collapsing into a new Great Depression.
And there was a lot of controversy when we went off of it. 1968, the big year?
Well, in 1968, President Johnson asked Congress to change the law so that the Fed would no longer have to maintain any gold backing for the dollar. Up until then, it had to maintain 25% gold backing. So I think that was the major break.
And in those days, we talked a lot about all the money in Fort Knox, although that actually wasn't as much money there as there was in New York's underground vault in Manhattan, which holds 225.1 million ounces of Troy, although some of it's in trust for foreign nations, central banks, and other organizations. But why is that money there if we're not on the gold standard?
Good question. Maybe they feel that one day we will collapse and need that real money again.
In 1968, we still had 3 years to go in the Bretton Woods agreement. What happened in between?
Well, the main thing that happened during the 1960s is so many dollars went overseas, mostly because of not only the Vietnam War, but also U.S. corporations and banks were investing heavily abroad. And at that time, other countries had the right to convert their dollars into U.S. gold. So during the 60s, the U.S. lost half of its gold reserves, 250 million ounces of gold.
They were saying, send the gold to us?
That's right. Here, you take your paper dollars, we'll take your gold.
Well, that of course, that's changed now. The dollar is kind of like the standard for trade all over the world, isn't it?
Well, since my first book was published 10 years ago, it was called The Dollar Crisis. The dollar has lost 75% of its value against gold.
Mm-hmm. Although I just read the other day that the gold bubble has burst. You think that's true?
No. Well, again, over the last 10 years, gold has gone from less than $300 an ounce to as high as $1,900. But it didn't go straight up. Now there have been four times when it corrected about 25%. Mm-hmm. I think it's now in one of those corrections. I think it will go higher.
The American dollar became what's called a fiat currency. What does that mean? And how did that transform our economy?
Fiat just means the government is free to make as much of it as it wants. It's a fancy way of saying paper money.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the government can print as much money as it wants.
That's right.
But that we also have the example of what happened in Germany between the wars. So we don't overdo it, do we?
Well, we'll find out.
Oh, you think that we've been pushing it?
So far, I don't think, you know, we're verging on massive deflation rather than hyperinflation at the moment. And if the government doesn't spend enough and print enough, then it's likely that we're going to suffer extreme deflation, as in during the Great Depression.
Well, the government isn't spending enough, according to whom? The Democrats are saying we should spend more. Republicans are saying, no, we have to cut down on the national debt and we should spend less.
Right. Well, I think what most people are missing is that after a $50 trillion, four-and-a-half-decade credit explosion, if credit stops expanding now, it's very likely that we're going to collapse into a multi-decade depression. And the only thing that's keeping credit from contracting now is the trillion-dollar annual budget deficits every year.
So what is money as opposed to credit? Are they the same thing?
Yeah, again, good question. There used to be a big difference under the gold standard. Gold was money and credit was credit. Now, however, well, back then, if you took a dollar bill to the Treasury, they were meant to give you some gold. Now they just give you another paper dollar. So what's the difference between – now paper dollar is more or less a credit instrument.
Well, so it's the money and credit are different from value, aren't they? But I remember my economics teacher in college telling me that this country is worth a lot more than the gold that it had stored away. It also – it's our wealth is dependent on natural resources, what's under the ground still, our manufacturing capability, the things that we grow, the value of land. So is that no longer true?
Well, I'm not sure that was ever true. I think the point here is that...
She tested me on it.
Well, the point is when we were on a gold standard, the government couldn't create any money, and that constrained how much credit we could create. Afterwards, there was an explosion of credit, and that drove up asset prices. That shifted the economy from being manufacturing-based to being service-based, i.e. banking and real estate. That can change the whole economy in a bad direction.
Well, can an economy grow without credit expansion?
I think the economy, you know, even a gold standard was not a perfect system. Sometimes they didn't have enough gold, and then a decade or two later, they would find a new gold mine somewhere, and then they would suddenly have an inflation boom. So that wasn't a perfect system either.
And then William Jennings Bryan wanted to take us into a silver standard,
right?
Because it was a lot more silver than there was gold.
Right. So now our fiat money system is like silver on super steroids. It's much, much, much more paper than there is silver.
My guest is Richard Duncan. His book, The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, it's published by Wiley. What's fractional reserve banking?
Fractional reserve banking, the idea is that in the old days, banks were required to keep liquidity reserves on hand in case the depositors came and asked for their deposits. And the higher the liquidity reserve ratio, the less credit they could create. And over time, the Fed lowered and lowered the liquidity reserve ratio until the amount of credit that the banks could create grew exponentially.
So can you give us an example of how a deposit of $100 worth of gold can turn into $500 at the reserve requirement of 20%?
Well, there's a very good illustration of that in my book, with a table that it shows exactly how that works. It's a bit complicated to explain, but the idea is if $100 of gold is deposited, say, in the 1890s, and the reserve ratio is 20%, then the banks had to keep $20 of gold, and being banks, they could lend out the other $80 of gold. And then those dollars, that $80 would end up on deposit in some other bank, and that bank would have to keep 20% of that $80, and they could lend out the rest. And the amount that they could lend out ended up being 1 over the reserve ratio or 5 times.
The money multiplier.
The money multiplier.
Now, did the banks, anybody ever go into a bank and say, I want my gold?
Yes, they did.
Because the bills, actually, our dollar bills used to say that it was worth $1 worth of gold. But I don't remember anybody ever asking for gold.
They asked for their deposits pretty recently in London. There were long lines outside the banks, and the banks would have completely failed had they not been bailed out by the government.
So how has the reduction of the gold standard affected the way that fractional reserve banking works?
Well, I think they were two separate things. And we went off the gold standard. That was one thing. And then the Fed steadily reduced the liquidity reserve ratio from about 14% ratio at the end of World War II down to less than 1%, meaning the money multiplier moved toward infinity. Now, so they're in a sense separate, but I don't think so much credit could have been created by the banks had we remained on a gold standard, because credit is effectively, you can create a multiple of the credit of the gold.
So if the current situation is not working and the gold standard wouldn't work anymore, have people proposed new ideas?
Not very many people are proposing new ideas, no.
That makes it sound like we're between a rock and a hard place.
I think it's time for people to begin proposing new ideas.
As early as 1912, the economist Irving Fisher said, irredeemable paper money has almost invariably proved a curse to the country employing it. So there were people off the gold standard way back when.
Yes, I mean, throughout history, the reason that we have all typically been on a gold standard is people simply refuse to accept paper money from governments because almost inevitably the governments debase the money and it loses its value over time. That's why gold was money to begin with.
What's the difference between time deposit and demand deposit?
Well, in the old days, a demand deposit was a deposit you could, write a check on, for instance, whereas a time deposit, you had to lock it up for a number of months or years.
I would assume commercial banks prefer time deposits to demand deposits.
That's right. And they had to, that way they could have a, the law was that they could have a lower reserve ratio on those, so they could lend them more often and make more profits.
My guest is Richard Duncan. His book, The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy. It's published by Wiley. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guest is Richard Duncan, the author of three books on the global economic crisis, The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, and Cures. Was a previous one. The current one is The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, which is published by Wiley. Your title suggests that you think the current situation is something of a depression rather than the Great Recession that it's often called.
Well, I think we're verging on collapsing into a new depression. Now, I think the Austrian economists were very clever in understanding the role that credit plays in creating economic boom and bust. As long as credit expands, prosperity expands. But the day always arrives when credit stops expanding. And when that occurs, then the prosperity doesn't just flatten out at a high level. Everything spirals into reverse and the depression occurs.
Well, we've had a number of times when credit didn't expand, and that has led to a number of recessions, but they've always corrected themselves.
Well, going back to 1952, if you adjust for inflation, there have only been 9 years when credit grew by less than 2%. Every time we had a recession, and that recession didn't end until we had another very big surge of credit expansion. Now, this time, the question is credit going to expand again or not? If you look at the private sector, it seems that it's incapable of taking on any more debt. It's only the massive increase in the government debt so far that has prevented the total credit from contracting and a new depression from beginning.
So what can we do to prevent that? The government continuing to take on more debt? Isn't the current feeling that, if anything, the government should take on less debt?
Well, that is the current feeling, and that's very dangerous for our country and for the world, because it is only this government debt that's preventing us from collapsing into a depression. If credit begins to contract, we will spiral into a new depression, and we will relive the 1930s and the 1940s.
Well, Keynesian economics is all about taking on debt when things are bad and then paying it off when things are good. Wouldn't that happen again? Or is the situation so dire that we can't really expect to see another boom where we might be able to pay off our debt?
Well, of course, the Keynesian economics is about the government taking on more debt and then paying it off when the
Well, that's what you're saying is what's keeping us going right now.
That's right. The problem is this can't go on forever. The U.S. economy is effectively unviable the way it's currently structured because of globalization. American workers are competing against overseas workers who are paid $5 a day. So the U.S. economy is deindustrializing. And median income in the country is dropping. So we're on government life support, but the government can't keep supporting us this way forever. It may be another 5 or even 10 years, but then after that, the U.S. government will be as bankrupt as Greece.
How significant is the growing gap between rich and poor in this country?
I think it's very significant because, if for no other reason, if you take some of the wealth from the top and distribute it more widely at the bottom, then that's going to create more consumption. I have nothing against billionaires, but economically speaking, the problem with billionaires is they don't consume enough. They can only wear one pair of tennis shoes at a time and watch a few TVs at a time. So it'd be a better idea for us to try to increase the wages of the people at the bottom of the pyramid. Then they could consume more, they'd be better off, and the billionaires would be better off too.
But we're moving in the opposite direction. There was a time when the United States economy was booming and the tax rate on billionaires was quite high, something like 90%, although I doubt anybody really paid that much. But still, it was a lot higher than it is today, and yet the argument against raising taxes for billionaires is that they're the job creators, and they need that money to create jobs.
There are many arguments put forth for lowering taxes on billionaires, but I think that in the end, everyone is going to be better off if the people at the bottom of the pyramid have a higher wage so they can spend more and consume more. Then the middle class will become richer and the rich will become richer and we'll all prosper together.
Well, we're seeing the shrinking of unions, which were, and their role was to bring up the wages of the people at the bottom. So we're moving in the opposite direction, aren't we?
Well, that's right. Because of globalization, I've lived in Asia for the last 25 years, in Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand. I've watched all of those economies boom because of the expansion of their manufacturing base. They manufacture things to make and sell to the Americans, and the Americans buy these things on credit, and that's created a big global boom that has put extreme downward pressure on U.S. wages.
But hasn't that also led to problems in the countries that went through those booms? Japan, for example, went through a boom and then it hit a wall. People are suggesting that China might very well have the same thing happen to it. The United States took longer to hit the wall, didn't it?
Well, all of these, the entire global crisis is, in one sense, a crisis of trade imbalances financed with credit. So your point's exactly right. Japan had a very big trade surplus with the U.S. A lot of foreign dollars went into Japan's economy. That caused credit to boom. That created a very big economic boom, 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 until the gardens around the Imperial Palace in Tokyo were said to be more valuable than California. And then the bubble popped. Every bubble is caused by credit expansion. And the surplus countries, their credit expands because their dollars expand because of their trade surplus. And yes, that's exactly what's happened to China. China now has the biggest economic bubble in history. It's only a matter of time before it pops.
And then where would we expect to see the next expansion? In India, in South America, in Africa?
We've already had a global this is no longer just a matter of a country like Japan or a region like the Asia crisis countries in the 90s. This has become a global bubble because the U.S. trade deficit grew to be $800 billion in 2006.
What's the U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's global savings glut theory?
Well, the savings glut theory was as follows. Bernanke told us all that the reason the United States was blown into an economic bubble and had a big property bubble was because other countries like China saved so much, the hardworking Chinese factory workers who earn $5 a day, they saved so much money that they couldn't find any viable place to invest it in China, even though China's economy was booming at 10% a year. So they had to buy treasury bonds, these Chinese factory workers earning $5 a day. And they bought so many treasury bonds, it pushed up the price of the bonds and pushed down the yield, so interest rates were low and the property market bubbled, and it's all their fault.
And you think that his global savings glut theory is not valid?
No, it's obviously not.
But the man
valid.
Is running the Federal Reserve.
Yes, he
does
is.
Does that affect U.S. economic policy?
Yes, it does affect policy, of course.
In 2007, leaders from the rest of the world supplied 15% of all credit within the United States, which was roughly $7 trillion. Why is that dangerous for us?
Well, so the point here is other countries build up foreign exchange reserves. Now, China has $3 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. And in total in the world, there are $10 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, of which about $7 trillion are in dollars. The way they accumulate these dollars, their central bank prints money from thin air, and it buys all the dollars coming into China, for instance, in order to prevent China's currency from appreciating. In other words, to manipulate China's currency. And once the central bank buys the $3 trillion, they have to put these dollars back into U.S. dollar assets in order to earn some interest on them. And so they would like to buy treasury bonds. But what we've seen for up until the crisis started, for 12 years, the trade deficit was so much bigger than the budget deficit. In other words, the central banks were accumulating so many dollars, there simply weren't enough treasury bonds to put them all in. And so they bought Fannie and Freddie bonds and also corporate bonds and stocks, and that blew this country into an economic bubble.
Well, the United States now, the dollar is depressed, as you pointed out. But doesn't that usually help to ease the trade surplus?
The problem is that China's currency, in the mid-80s, the U.S. had a big trade deficit for the first time. And we had the Plaza Accord. And the agreement there globally was that the yen and the mark would be devalued by 50% against the dollar. And that was enough to bring the trade back into balance, the trade deficit back into balance. Now, the U.S. has a $300 billion a year trade deficit with China. But Chinese wages, 80% of the people in China earn less than $10 a day. So even if China's currency were, even if the U.S. dollar were devalued by 50% or 70% against the Chinese currency, that would only take Chinese wages up to $20 a day at the most, and their trade surplus with the U.S. would continue expanding.
But we're already hearing about China developing a large middle class. So is it just a matter of time before China becomes the equivalent of Japan, or is it too big for that to happen?
It's too big, and the demographic trends are too adverse. The fact is 80% of the Chinese people earn less than $10 a day. Now, when the U.S. crisis started, China's exports to the U.S. dropped. This almost popped China's bubble then. The headline was 20 million factory workers go back to the countryside to work in agriculture. The policy response to that in China was China allowed its banks to grow their bank loans. Total bank loans grew by 60% in 2 years. 60%. So just imagine what would happen in the U.S. if total bank loans here grew by 60% in 24 months. Property prices would triple, everybody would have a job, wages would go up, and then no one would be able to repay the bank loans, and the banking system would collapse and have to be bailed out by the government. That's where China is now.
My guest is Richard Duncan. His latest book, The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy, is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener, Antonio, I guess, in Bayside, asks, who's better to stop this dire prediction, Obama or Romney?
Well, I think what we're going to see is that whoever is elected, they will continue to keep government debt expanding. Because, let's face it, Congress has to be elected every 2 years. So if the Republicans swept into power and actually implement the Tea Party platform and radically cut government spending, well, government spending makes up 24% of GDP. If you radically cut government spending, unemployment is going to skyrocket into the double digits. Consumption is going to drop. Profits are going to drop. And all the Republicans will be sent home in 2014. So they can't cut government spending regardless of what they say. It's just a matter of how they spend the money.
But many of them are elected with Tea Party backing, promising that they're not going to spend that money.
Well, implement their policies, and within a couple of years, they will all go home. But the interesting thing is perhaps they will do what President Reagan did. President Reagan said that the government's not the solution, the government's the problem. But President Reagan cut taxes, and he drastically increased military spending. And that created the biggest budget deficits in U.S. history, 5% of GDP for 5 years in a row. U.S. government debt increased by 188% under President Reagan. And so President Reagan used government debt to solve his problems, and that created the boom of the 1980s.
Well, why didn't that work with the two wars that were created during the Bush administration's time, where once again government debt went zooming up?
It did work. The expansion of government debt is one of the reasons the economy pulled out of the recession of 2001.
But 2007, suddenly we had this economic crisis, 2008. Did you predict that financial meltdown?
In fact, I did. If you will read my book, The Dollar Crisis, you'll see that the theme of that book was that the U.S. trade deficit was destabilizing the global economy and that it would result in a, when the property bubble popped, result in a severe global recession, a systemic banking sector crisis in the U.S., and necessitate trillion-dollar budget deficits and unorthodox monetary policy to prevent a depression.
Well, you weren't alone in that, but you were one of very few. Why do you think more of the experts weren't paying attention to that?
I think my advantage, at least, was because I had lived in Asia and seen so many boom and bust cycles there. I was managing a research department in Thailand during the first part of the 1990s, from 90 until 96, and I saw the great Asia crisis bubble emerge and then pop. And so it didn't come as a surprise to me that I understood that credit creates the boom and every boom bust.
And you'd worked at the World Bank?
After Thailand.
Mm-hmm. And that gave you some insight into the situation as well? Well,
that was very interesting because I just watched a massive bubble form and pop in Thailand. Then I moved to Washington in 1998. And even though my colleagues were very hardworking and well-meaning, most of them were speculating wildly in Cisco shares, just as the NASDAQ bubble was forming. And they thought it was a new paradigm, as did most people in the country. But it wasn't. It was one more credit bubble, and it popped in 2001.
For years, we were told that if Americans just saved more, we wouldn't have some of the problems we have.
Well, I'm sure in the old days it would have been a good thing if we had continued to save more, but now we're in a completely different world where our economy is no longer driven in the way it was under capitalism. Under capitalism, growth was driven by investment and savings, hence capital accumulation or capitalism. But now economic growth in this country is driven in a completely different way, by credit creation and consumption, and more credit creation and more consumption. And that created very, very rapid economic growth for four decades. The problem is this new system, creditism, can't create any more growth because the private sector can't bear any more debt. And if the government debt stops increasing, then we're going to spiral into a 1930s-style depression.
John, a listener, asks, how does deflation, which you talked about earlier, play out? Does commerce magically stop immediately? Are there any examples of countries that survive at very low or even zero inflation?
Well, the thing to understand is that because of the U.S. trade deficit grew to be so enormous, it peaked at $800 billion in 2006, that allowed the rest of the world to expand their industrial capacity to meet that demand from the U.S. So now there's massive excess capacity across every industry globally. And that excess capacity had been absorbed by the Americans borrowing money from their homes, equity extraction, and spending it and consuming it. But once that stopped, now it's only the government debt that is absorbing that global excess capacity. So we wouldn't, if the bubble actually pops, if our credit bubble pops, then we wouldn't just have minus 1 or 2% deflation. It would be like in the 1930s when we had severe double-digit deflation and prices would spiral downward across the board.
And then unemployment would go up to, how high was it during the Depression?
It ranged from 15% to 25% all during the 30s until World War II started, and then government spending increased by 900%. And that ended the Depression, but that also killed 60 million people.
Now, can we talk a bit about quantitative easing, which is another controversial kind of money policy? How many rounds of quantitative easing have we had in total?
We had QE1 and QE2, but we also had the equivalent in Europe, which they called LTRO, where the European Central Bank created roughly a trillion new euros.
So we've had a new one. We had one in 2010 because we realized there was another major crisis. Has that had a positive effect?
Well, each of these rounds of paper money creation had the impact of pushing up stock prices and commodity prices. And that created a wealth effect, for at least on the stock side. And that wealth effect allowed more consumption to occur and supported the economy for a while. The problem is each time that these ended, then the stock market dropped and the economy moved back into weakness.
And now there's talk of a QE3.
Yes.
Is this something you think would be a good idea?
Well, it's something that I thought was going to be necessary, and I think eventually will be. But the big drawback with QE is that it creates extreme food price inflation. During the second round of quantitative easing, global food prices went up 60%. And that created a humanitarian disaster for the 2 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. And in fact, this sparked off the Arab Spring across the Middle East. As food prices went up, the hungry people started rioting and overthrowing their governments. So now we have a big problem. Now there's the drought in the U.S. And because of this act of God, food prices are already very high again. Corn's at a record high. Soybeans are high. If they come around now with another round of quantitative easing, then food prices are going to double. And this is, once again, going to be a humanitarian disaster with unknown geopolitical consequences.
We're often told that if we just buy more, if there was an increase in domestic consumption, that that would solve the problem.
Well, that would solve the problem. The problem is that to do that, wages have to be higher, or else credit has to expand, and the people can't repay the credit they have already, and wages are dropping.
So in just a few moments that we have left, what are the solutions? Are there any?
Yes, the solution is for us to understand that we don't have a capitalist system. This new system is creditism, and it requires credit growth to survive. And the only part of our economy that can expand credit further now is the government. So what we need to do is learn from Japan's crisis. Japan's crisis started 22 years ago. Their government debt has gone from 60% of GDP to 240% of GDP.
Are they still suffering from it?
They're still benefiting from it because their economy hasn't collapsed into a Great Depression. But the trick is to not waste all the money the way that the Japanese did, but to actually instead borrow and spend this money at the government level, but on investments, on transformative 21st century cutting-edge technologies. Invest over the next 10 years, I'd like to see the government invest $1 trillion in solar energy, and $1 trillion in genetic engineering, and $1 trillion in nanotechnology, and $1 trillion in biotechnology. And if they do, the United States can have an absolutely unassailable lead in these 21st century industries. We can lock in another American century, and the investment returns on these projects would be so enormous. Not only would they pay for themselves, they would pay for themselves many times over.
Well, we had the president proposing high-speed rail, and many governors said, not in my state. So how do you even do these things? I mean, it's nice for you to say $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there, but I suspect you're not going to get anybody in Congress and many of the governors to go along with that.
Probably not. But how do you do it? Well, you write books and you at least talk to people over the radio.
And you wait for the depression to occur and then people get desperate. Is that what might happen?
I'm afraid that what is likely to occur is that we're going to follow the Japan model, and that we'll continue to have massive budget deficits every year for the next 5 to 10 years, and that will support us and keep us out of depression, but we will waste all the money on too much consumption and war, and then we'll have a depression, and then it will be too late.
And a caller is wondering how we should be protecting our personal wealth under these circumstances.
Well, if the global economy collapses into a new Great Depression, there's no place to hide, frankly. But the best you can do, I think, is look, you need to develop cash flow, I believe. In other words, if you can afford to build up a portfolio of rental properties without taking on too much credit, and whatever credit you do take on, borrow at fixed interest rates, then if we have a depression, okay, your rents are going to drop radically, but the price of everything else is going to drop radically also, and you will preserve your wealth, and you will have some income, and you will be able to buy food. And also, you better keep some gold coins around buried under the front porch, because they won't be accepting paper money in that sort of scenario.
Richard Duncan's book, The New Depression, has depressed me just a bit, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy. It's published by Wiley. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.